Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. A little bit of a trigger warning, I suppose. I want to use the term carefully, but I'm going to be talking, if only briefly, about what we might typically think of as abuse. I'm not going to be talking about that in any detail, but more in general themes, but I want you to know that in advance. And if there's things you need to do to kind of listen with care, I want to inform and permission those. The longer I live, and I realize this sounds terribly obvious, perhaps, but the longer that I live, the more convinced I am that change is hard. For a couple of years now in my other work, I've been asking people why we might, as human beings, stay in spaces where we're in danger. Why don't we leave? Because sometimes we do leave, sometimes we don't, sometimes we leave and then we go back, we leave and then we go back, we leave and then we go back. Somebody in a group I was facilitating recently, when we were talking about this, we were talking about things where we've changed a habit, and anybody wanted to talk about that, and he said, yeah, I'll tell my story a little bit. I said, what was the habit that you changed? He said, I quit smoking. I said, how'd that go? He said, well, it took 20 years. You know, that's like we do that, right? We leave and we go back, we leave and we go back. So I've gotten quite a variety of answers, but there are some that show up in terms of why we don't leave, why we don't change when we're in danger. There are some that show up over and over again as themes. And one of those is an answer along the lines of because of the unknown, or because we're afraid that the alternative to where we are might be worse. We're not sure, but that's our concern. So my mom would have said in terms of a folk saying, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. This is kind of in that space for lots of us, right? And I feel like that little folk saying, like good ones often do, that really kind of captures the dilemma, at least from my vantage point. Change is hard, even change that has the potential to move us away from danger. And, I mean, there are myriad reasons why that's the case. We're creatures of habit. Familiarity, goes the saying, breeds contempt. Or if not contempt, then perhaps complacency or even a sort of kind of rough around the edges version of comfort. This is the danger I know. I'm familiar with this hazard. I don't know what the alternative would be. I'm not familiar with that. And so knowing what the deal is, knowing what's going on around us, grounds us. It gives us a sense that we know where we are, that we have some idea what's coming. And even to our conversation a few moments ago, right? One of the reasons, there's many reasons why all these conflicts are hard on us as humans, but one of them is because they destabilize our sense of feeling confident about what's coming. And uncertainty equals danger to us, and danger pokes the fear bear. And fear is an extremely potent emotion. So living in spaces where we don't know what the deal is, that's hard on us. That's perhaps a reason why the fact that as a community we're uncertain of our home space is wearing, right? I think that's one of the reasons why, for example, the pandemic has such a long echo. It was this hard-to-ignore reminder that we can't always know what's coming, and when a message gets delivered, when that kind of message gets delivered on that scale, it's really hard to deny, even if acknowledging it or considering it runs across the grain of our belief system. Maybe especially if it runs across the grain of our belief system. I mention all of that because recovery from trauma of any kind, including the religious kind, can take us into a space like that. It's not that hard to talk about recovery or healing in hopeful terms, right? Maybe even in glowing terms. I mean, who doesn't love a good, I'm healed story, you know? I was a captive to thing X, but now I'm free is lovely, and it sells a lot of memoirs. Also, I don't know if you've noticed the the billboard around town lately that says "Addicted, Jesus Frees" or whatever the little tagline is, right? Like this is a sellable story. It's a harder pill to swallow when we know something about the process, about the demands, about the details of moving from "I am captive to something" to "I am no longer bound by that something." Because although I think most of us would agree that it's better to heal than to stay wounded, most of us also might not know very much about the cost of that kind of journey. Now, I can appreciate that the approach that I've chosen to take sort of in the early going of this talky bit might sound a bit off-putting. It might sound like I'm sort of gently setting up trying to talk the wounded out of pursuing healing or wholeness. That is not the case. However, it's been my experience personally, as well as the conclusion of many people more experienced and better versed than me in the intricacies of healing from trauma of all sorts, that that path can be long and difficult, and that we don't do ourselves or anyone else any favors if we pretend otherwise. I once heard a comedian, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember this person's name. I've often wanted to look them up. If you're aware of who this is, let me know. But somebody who became blind as an adult, they're one of the very few non-sighted comedians working professionally these days. They had several eye surgeries along the way. It wasn't an event. It was a process. And I've heard them talk about how helpful it was to have an eye surgeon once say to them right before they began a procedure, "This is going to hurt." And as they tell it, their respect for the surgeon went up, not down, not least of all because the surgeon was right. It did hurt. That's not the joke. The joke is the punchline to that little piece in the comedian's act is they're like, "So I think that maybe, you know, when people are getting married, like the officiant should say," and then they do that little pause for the joke, and everybody in the room's like, "Oh, gotcha, this is going to hurt," right? Healing from, or walking the road to recovery from trauma, for most of us, it's going to hurt. And for good or ill, I can't find it in me to soft pedal that, even though I suspect that doing so might feel better in the moment. Also, this is not an unsupported opinion of Tim. Let me get into some of the agreed-upon steps from the practitioners in this realm about this journey of healing, and I think you'll see what I mean as we go. I'm going to explore this part of this Deep End series in three segments, as far as I can tell at this point. In the first segment, I want to talk a little bit about the bodily impact of trauma in general, so we'll do some of that today, and I want to apply that information to religion and religious trauma in particular. And then in the second segment, we'll consider what recovery might entail, and in the third, we'll dip into what rebuilding might look like, because we're talking about trauma that intersects with a belief system or belief systems here. So we're not quite done with the topic yet. If it gets too heavy, other things come up, we'll turn away, turn back, but overall, that's where we're headed. So we've explored a bit about what trauma is, and we've considered a couple of the prevailing ideas about how to put language to it, things like unclosed loops, unexpelled energy, the past not being in the past, and so on. One of the reasons all of these ideas sometimes don't settle readily is because they all feature some version of disconnection. It's easier to understand how trauma could result from extreme cases of physical or sexual abuse, let's say, partly because we can either literally see the wounds or we can more readily imagine the damage. Psychological abuse and impact are harder to see than direct physical abuse. But it's psychological abuse that claims more victims. You might remember, this was several weeks ago now, you also might not, but you might remember me relating a story from a researcher in this realm about a missile attack that happened in the Middle East at one point, where the majority of the victims on day one, where no one was actually physically killed by the attack, that first day had more fatalities than any of the days that had direct hits. Far more people died from the psychological trauma of that barrage than from the physical trauma of it. It's very powerful. Here's one of the complexities. When it comes to psychological trauma, psychological abuse, more correctly, many of the victims don't even know that they're victims. And there are several reasons why this might be the case, but one of the repeat offenders is a systemic one. Most of us are aware of cases of physical or sexual abuse perpetuated within religious structures. They tend to make the news, right? The priest that abuses a parishioner, the religious organizational leader or pastor who abuses a staff member, a congregant, the counselor that abuses a client, and so on. Calling those sorts of events trauma clicks more easily into place than psychological trauma does. But that same obviousness is part of the problem. Because a worldview that features anticipated future horror can readily produce, especially in the young, a constant state of dread or panic from which there is no escape except into eternal damnation. That's the only way out in those systems of belief. Many of us would readily acknowledge that other extremist doctrines can be damaging. We don't even blink when the newscaster cites radicalization as the reason for someone's destructive behavior. We've kind of normalized that math. But we might not find it so easy to acknowledge that extremist Christian beliefs, or whichever religious system we are closest to, we might not find it so easy to acknowledge that extremist Christian beliefs might be just as problematic as any other stripe of extremist beliefs. Part of the reason for that may well be that these viewpoints can be normalized in our surrounding cultural context. I once heard an artist, musician from the southern U.S. say that in their town growing up, the question wasn't do you go to church, but where do you go to church? That belief systems that had at their centerpiece Christianity were just the norm. I mean, in this part of the world, I would say that kind of pervasive Christian subculture would be a little bit more unusual. But if we're surrounded by Christian everything, especially when we're young, it's harder to acknowledge the potential harm of the more radical versions of what we're familiar with, right? Because we might be in a version of that belief system that doesn't feel so extreme, which might make it harder for us to see the version that is. And one of the potential upshots is that we don't recognize that fundamentalist belief can just churn out the walking wounded at an incredible rate. Another aspect of why this sort of trauma might be harder to see is because many of these teachings, the ones that form the ground for trauma, can cause us to disassociate from our own bodies. So we're so disconnected because of our exposure to the teaching that we can't recognize that the teaching is doing us harm. The disconnect is getting in the way of us knowing that we're in harm's way. One of the scholars in this realm, Peter Levine, points out that the bottom line regarding trauma is what has registered as traumatic to an organism is in their individual felt sense. So to Mate's idea that I mentioned the other day, it's not the blow on the head, it's the concussion. It's not what happens, it's what happens in you as a result of what happens. That's the trauma. To apply that idea to what we're considering, someone who has spent their formative years interacting with teachings, for example, that demand holiness, might choose to disassociate from their body in order to become holy, as they've heard it described. I can't actually honestly acknowledge what's going on in my body and also meet this standard. So I have to, something's got to give. And what gives is my own connection to myself. What suffers is my own awareness of what's going on in me. Certain patterns of thought or fixation on an imagined reality, so burning forever, for example, can be equally traumatizing as direct interactive abuse because there's no opportunity for release or resolution or safety. There's no way out of that idea loop. Research indicates that significant stress can arise from merely thinking about something unpleasant in commonplace experiences. And probably an example many of us can relate to is like taking a test, an exam. If we've been formed in an environment where perfection, holiness, in religious language, is required or demanded but never attainable, that can readily cause daily interconflict and fractured self-worth. Basil van der Kolk, Dr. van der Kolk, one of the founders of all of this realm of thinking, puts it this way. He says, suppressing inner cries for help does not stop our stress hormones from mobilizing the body. I can tell my brain, you don't need to worry about that. But that doesn't tell my body, you don't need to worry about that. I can tell my conscious thoughts, you don't need to be afraid of this. It's not logical to be afraid of this. But that doesn't stop my body from experiencing fear. What happens instead is that those cries show up as physical symptoms that demand our attention in order to heal. It's our body's way of trying to get our attention, to remind us that there's something here that needs tending to. Some of the researchers that I was reading, I won't kind of get into all of it here, but there's a whole new field of study that is about the profound connection between our neurobiology and our biology in general and how many of the things that we experience as illness are connected to our nervous system. Our brains and our immune systems are deeply connected by nerve connections. The tissues of the immune system are bound to the central nervous system. One of the researchers in this realm, somebody named Dr. Paul Martin, says it this way. He says, the brain and the nervous system speak the same language. So there's a powerful link between how we feel about ourselves and how we actually physically feel. Now, I'm not ignoring or dismissing the fact that genetic factors come into play here. However, it's often environmental factors that contribute to the full development and expression of many physical conditions. So that's where those paths cross in a discernible way. So it follows that the removal of traumatizing ideas, language, power structures can help remove systemic triggers for some physical imbalances. You might remember that last week I suggested that in order to begin a healing journey in this space, we might need three things. We might need to release ourselves from the harmful environment. We need to establish a sense of safety, and we need to give ourselves permission to believe a different story about ourselves, the world, and whatever we're using God language for. If we have experienced religious trauma or its attendant syndromes, a lot of the folks who are on the how do we recover from this, how do we heal from this side, would sort of break their process down into those three things. Release from a harmful environment, establish a sense of safety, give ourselves permission to believe a different story about ourselves, the world, and whatever we're using God language for. When environmental triggers that are preventing someone from feeling safe in their own bodies are removed, or when we release ourselves from being in environments where those triggers are present, we can begin to reconnect with ourselves. And beginning to reconnect with ourselves is the beginning of healing from these traumas. To be formed, traumatized in some cases, in environments that consistently disempower us can lead to quite dramatic experiences of disconnection. In an excerpt, I hope no one can relate directly to this because of its extremity, but if you do, just know that your story has company. In an excerpt from her book, Leaving the Fold, Marlene Winnell, the person who basically gave us the term religious trauma syndrome as a researcher, she tells a story in that book of a woman who's recovering from her experience of fundamentalist beliefs who says this. This is a quote. My friend said that when she first left that harmful environment, all she knew was that her favorite color was pink and what her name was. She's fine now, and I will be too. Another person that I was reading tells a story of not even knowing what her favorite color was because she had been so surrounded by a world that discouraged specific pleasures or the expression of personal desires, both of which form the foundation of something as seemingly benign as knowing what your favorite color is. And she goes on to tell a story about being in a ministry training school where the person who was leading the session invited them to make a list of all the things that brought them joy, and she was unable to do so. She said, I sat in front of that blank page for half an hour. I couldn't write a single thing on it because there was no one in that space who was telling me what I was allowed to write on it. And the reason was, as she tells the story, was that she had spent so long being taught to distrust her own inner voice, to distrust the influence of herself, because in those systems of belief, that self is broken and rebellious and cannot be depended on, except to lead you astray, because you're a sinner. That she found herself in her mid-20s without even one answer for what she uniquely loved, for what she wanted, or what brought her joy. She says, quote, I had no connection to or relationship with my own inner compass for simple desire or for uninfluenced embodied pleasure. In other words, without an authority figure telling her it's okay to find joy in thing X, she couldn't give herself permission to name anything at all. Framed like this, it's probably not a surprise to learn that someone at this stage might struggle, as this person did, with self-harm, in this case through eating habits or with anxiety and depression. However, we might be a little bit surprised to learn that they were also afraid to seek a decent paying job until we connect the dots that doing so might be considered selfish or greedy because you're doing it for you. They self-describe as having no capacity for resolution, stillness, or calm within themselves, as well as no permission for pleasure or knowing about their inner world. In their words, quote, I was stuck in a lengthy holding pattern, waiting upon external divine, quotes around divine, influence to move me in one direction or another and to tell me what I could be free to enjoy and to love. In all the stories that I've referenced above and in so many more, there's a crucial step that involves stepping away from, or as we called it a few moments ago, releasing ourselves from the harmful environment. Now, a sentence like that can be clarifying, as in, I need to release myself from my harmful environment. That kind of clarity can be essential, galvanizing, empowering. It can also be dangerously naive if we think that we're describing a one-and-done type of maneuver. But I want to sort of set that into a little larger frame, and I'll end with this. There's a moment in C.S. Lewis's classic Pilgrim's Progress where the pilgrim character, John, is looking back over his life's journey with his guide, and he's observing how labyrinthian and serpentine it is. It's just all over. I wrestled a bit with whether or not I wanted to reference this quote, not least of all because Lewis has been a bit of a darling in many settings where these helpful belief or harmful belief systems we've been examining have also thrived. So I'm going to use it with that caveat because I personally believe that in many of those settings, people were refusing to acknowledge that at the core of Lewis's worldview was an extremely generous notion of the divine, which embraced, among other things, religions other than his own. In this case, the work in question is an allegory, and the character of the landlord in the allegory in the quote is best understood as a character as the maker of the land in the story, which I think leaves quite a lot of room for interpretation. In any case, here's the guide's perspective on the complexity of the protagonist's journey. He says this to John. "You may be sure the landlord has brought you the shortest way, though I confess it would look an odd journey on a map." In the context of the book, that exchange is intended to reassure the protagonist that the unexpected, the difficult, even the apparently nonsensical are all legitimate parts of our path home. Lewis was also fond of quoting the traditional phrase, "the longest way round is the shortest way home." Releasing ourselves from a traumatizing religious environment will quite possibly include some fits and starts, some twists and turns, some moments where the whole enterprise really doesn't seem to make sense. And if it does seem to make sense to us, in all likelihood, there will be other people to whom it does not. In fact, it might not only not make sense to other people, but they might regard it as harmful to them. One of my therapist friends once said of the path to being more free, you know, the truth might set you free, but it'll almost always incarcerate you first. It's not uncomplicated. My hope, and it's one that I know I share with others in this community, is that the table can provide both a place of discovery and a place of rest on that sort of journey with all of those fits and starts. A place where we are all permissioned, we're encouraged, we're supported in exploring what we believe so that we can reconnect parts of ourselves that religion and religious teachings might have disconnected so that we can move forward in a journey of healing and hope, of reintegration of ourselves. Next time we're in this series, we'll pick up with some exploration of what recovery might look like. And until then, peace.